We're back with Mental Health Matters, and we've got an incredible guest today. You are listening to Mental Health Matters, KRUU FM 100.1, and you could also reach us at mentalhealthmatters@kruufm.com. You could email us about any ideas you have. But I'm Dr. Scott Terry, and my co-host is...
I'm Rob Hubler, and I'm glad to be here, and we are getting into the program.
So, introduce our incredible guest today.
Jerry Yellen. Everyone knows Jerry Yellen. I've seen him around town here for a number of years.
28, I think.
28, but you've been around the world, in this world, for how many years?
I'll be 91 in 19 days.
Incredible.
19 days is a good number, because if you reverse it, it's 91.
That's right. That's a great number. Well, happy birthday in advance.
So, Jerry, a lot of people don't know who you are or are listening from outside of Fairfield.
Right.
Tell us who you are and why you're one of the most incredible, powerful people I've ever known.
Well,
even heard about.
I appreciate you saying that, Doc, but I'm just one of an ordinary guy who, among 16 million young men in World War II, served their country. I was 17, graduated from high school in June of 1941, and had a scholarship to college, no money, out of the Depression. I was working in a steel mill. And so I postponed entrance into college to the spring semester of 1942. And then December 7th, 1941, Pearl Harbor happened, and I made up my mind that I was going to become a fighter pilot and fly against the Japanese. They attacked my country.
Wow.
So on my 18th birthday, February 15th, 1942, I enlisted in the Army Air Corps, passed the physical exam, passed the mental exam, flunked the physical exam. I had 20/30 vision in one eye. But my mom was on the draft board, and I asked her to bring me the eye chart, and I went back 3 days later, took the test, and I passed, and I was inducted into the Army.
You memorized the eye chart, right?
I memorized the eye chart, right. Well, you're talking about memory. I memorized the eye chart, and I soloed on February 22nd, 1943 at Thunderbird Field. I was the first one in my class to solo because my last name began with a Y and they started with the A's. Five guys with A and going through the alphabet, five guys to an instructor, and there were only three of us left over, Yellen, Zuniga, and another guy by the name of Z. So I got my time in first, and I was the first one to solo on February 22nd, 1943, 1 week into my 19th year. I graduated from flying school in August of 43 with 10 hours in a P-40. I was sent over to Hawaii with 28 of us from the squadron from my class, 43H, to get 50 hours in a P-40 and then be assigned to combat squadrons. Well, five of us, three guys from Iowa, Bob Roseberry, Bob Ruby, and Al Sharon, myself and Jack Patterson from Honolulu were kept in the 78th Fighter Squadron as permanent cadre, and we trained other pilots. And then we landed on Iwo Jima on March 7, 1945. Iwo Jima was invaded by the Americans, 60,000 American Marines against 23,000
Well dug in. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so I was in combat strafing for the Marines from March 7th, 45 till April 7th, 45. And then I flew on the very first mission, fighter mission ever flown over Japan on April 7th, 1945,
wow.
Escorting B-29s as they bombed Tokyo. And I did 19 runs, including the last combat mission of World War II, which 70 years ago was on August 14th, 1945. And on that mission, my wingman was killed. He was the last man killed in World War II in combat.
Seriously?
Seriously.
Wow.
So I was on the last mission flown in combat of the war. There were other missions flown between August 14th and September 2nd when they signed the armistice on the Missouri, but I'm sure There were no fighter missions. There were no combat. There was no shooting. This was the last mission of World War II.
Wow.
And we're going to celebrate the 70th anniversary this year, August 14th. 70 years. I was 21 then. I'll be 91 now.
And there's some real interesting timing issues politically. We were talking about Holocaust remembrance.
Two days ago was the end of the biggest battle. 600,000 American soldiers in the Battle of the Bulge ended on January 26th. So there was a big ceremony about that.
A lot of people don't know this stuff. A lot of people don't really know the history of World War II. So the Battle of the Bulge was one of the final big
That was the biggest battle of World War II that the Americans, 600,000 Americans. And if the weather had not cleared and the bombers were and the fighters were able to come in, we could have lost that battle and the war would have been extended way beyond May 9th or
because we prevailed in that battle. We were able to really push our way finally into Germany completely.
Yeah, that was the beginning of the end of Germany.
Absolutely.
That led up to, to June, what was it, June 6th?
Yeah. My birthday.
Yeah. June 6th was VE Day.
Yeah, yep.
Victory in Europe. Now, I don't know why they didn't call it VG Day, because we were fighting the Germans. They call August 14th, VE Day,
right.
A VJ Day, as victory over the Japanese. And it's time we started to think about, I'm trying to think about, getting August 14th to be recognized as the first day of world peace, not the last day of the war.
That's wonderful.
That's a great guy. Say more about that. Because we're talking about all these anniversaries, and we're also talking before the show a little bit about the 45 and the bills that have been going through Congress and some other things.
Well, war is a devastating entity for anybody who goes into it, who goes into combat. I can talk about that personally, and I will. But we were called the greatest generation. And I think we were called the greatest generation, not for what we did, but for what the leaders of our country did after the war ended. We were turned around, American ingenuity, American finance, American industry, rebuilt Japan, Germany, and Italy completely from devastation to prosperity to democracy, democratic countries that became our allies. And the guys that we fought against are now our allies. The guys we fought with, Russia mainly, is now supposedly an enemy of what America's doing.
Comes and goes.
So it changed around in 70 years. As far as being in combat, I don't know any soldier from World War II that I knew that ever spoke about the war. I had 11 relatives in war, in combat. And not one of us, when we got together, ever spoke about the war. I know that inwardly, I never, ever thought about my wartime experiences. From the time the combat ended on August 14th until the time I was asked to go to Japan in 1983, I never thought about the war. I couldn't sleep at night. I had nightmares. I thought about suicide. For all of the years until 1975, 40.
And your relationship with your wife wasn't all that
wonderful. Well, my relationship with my wife, she got damaged goods. She thought she was getting a good-looking, well-rounded guy, but I was a screwed-up mess. I gambled. I didn't drink, but I couldn't hold a job. I was suffering then for 30 years for what was known as now. It's post-traumatic stress disorder.
And then it was called shell shock.
And they called it shell shock or battle fatigue. And
spoke to
a doctor about it. Yeah, forget about it. It's over. Well, there's no way that you can replace the mind and the memories. It's a photographic record in your head of everything that you've ever done from the day that you're born. And some of us can recall it. Some of us can't recall it. But post-traumatic stress combat is devastating. And I didn't get over that until my wife saw Merv Griffith saw Maharishi on Merv Griffith's show in 1975, and she learned transcendental meditation in June or July of 1975, and I learned in August of 1975.
And that was the point of turnaround. Rob?
Let me interrupt just for a second. You're listening to KRUU Radio 100.1 on the radio dial. Solar-powered radio in Fairfield, Iowa. And let's go back to the Merv Griffin Show.
And we're talking today with Jerry Yellen, the famous and important Jerry Yellen, talking to us about not only things that happen during war, but how trauma happens and what we can do with that trauma. Because, as I've said a million times, trauma isn't about what happened. It's about what we did to ourselves then and afterwards, and are still doing ourselves.
Well, trauma and war are two different things. The pure purpose of war is to kill.
Yes.
The pure purpose of war is to kill your enemy. And everybody who goes into the military learns how to use a weapon, armor, handguns, rifles.
So tell us about the difference between trauma and war, because that is exactly the distinction I think that's missing.
Well, trauma is trauma.
Because just because somebody's going through war doesn't mean that they have trauma, right?
No. Guys go into the army, never go into combat. They don't have any trauma.
Well, even combat, some people who went through combat didn't necessarily have trauma.
Well, anybody who kills somebody, or learns how to kill somebody, goes into combat, there's no detraining from killing.
Right. Because you don't learn how to deal with the experience that just happened. No, you're not trained to how to deal with yourself. You're trained how to kill somebody else, not trained how to deal with yourself and having hurt somebody.
Well, you do that, you kill somebody. I killed people. I shot down 3.5 Japanese airplanes. Didn't kill half a person, but killed a whole person.
Yeah.
I strafed barracks. I strafed plants. I strafed boats with people on it. I don't know how many people I killed. And to me, it was my job. And when I came home and I started to think about it, I flew with 16 guys who didn't come back. I never thought about them as dying or being killed. They were transferred. If I ever thought about them, my friends being killed, I never would have been able to get into my P-51 and fly again. So you don't think about it. And then when it's over, you start to think about it. There's a difference between a trauma like an automobile accident or falling off a tree. That's one thing. You do something that hurts you. It's a traumatic experience. But killing somebody and then meeting those people that you thought were your enemy, that you thought were human beings. Like, I never thought the Japanese were human beings. They're a bunch of monsters, the things that they did. There's a movie out now, Unbroken. I read the book. I don't know if I'll go see the movie because it's just recalling all of the bad things about my family.
Right.
My youngest son, I was asked to go to Japan to talk about real estate in 1983. And I said, no, there's no way I'm going to Japan. Japan's not a place I want to visit. Japanese are not people. And I told that to Helene, my wife, and she said, you didn't ask me, so what do you think happened? 1983, I went to Japan. And I was blown away by the humanity, by the culture, by the beauty, by the food, by everything that I saw there. And on the last night that we were in Japan, we were at the old Miyako Hotel in Kyoto, and Helene said, you know, Robert would love Japan. We had four sons. Robert was a senior at San Diego State. So we came home, and I said, Rob, we're going to give you a graduation present. We're going to give you a trip overseas when you graduate from San Diego. I said, you have a 90% chance of going away if you take Japan, a 10% if you choose to go to Europe. He said, well, I'll go to Japan. So he went to Japan, had a great experience, and then didn't know what he was going to do. So he took a job teaching English in Japan for 1 year and left in 1984. And now it's 2015, 31 years later. He hasn't come back yet.
Really?
Yeah. In 1987, we were in Japan. He told us he was going to get married. He wanted to get married to this lady, Takako Yamakawa, that we had met. And I thought about the 16 guys that were killed and fast through my mind, but it was his life, not my life. So I said, what does her father think? And he said, well, he won't meet me. 7 months later, there was a family gathering with Takako and two of her older brothers and her father. And the two boys grilled my son mercilessly about his background, his religion, his ability to make a living, if he was going to take their sister back to America. The father didn't say anything. And finally, the father spoke, and he asked my son 5 questions. How old is your father? 63. Was in the war? Yes. What did he do? He was a pilot. What did he fly? P-51s. Where? Over Japan. Meeting ended. He went home and said to his wife, make the wedding. She went ballistic. You've been telling me for 40 years about the horrors of America and the Americans. They're not people. Why do you want to make a wedding? He said, well, any man that could fly a P-51 against Japan, against the Japanese Air Force, and live must be a brave man. I want the blood of that man to flow through the veins of our grandchildren. Mm-hmm. Well, this was a big lesson for me. 1988, on March 5th, almost 40 years, 43 years to the day that I went into combat, we attended a wedding in Japan. And Robert married this Japanese lady. He's got I have three grandchildren in Japan. One is 24. He's a physicist with a master's in physics. Another one is getting his master's degree on a scholarship at Oxford in England. He'll get his doctorate in America next year. And Sarah, my 18-year-old granddaughter, is going to go to a Tokyo University of Languages and Culture in April. And we have three beautiful family members who live in Japan. And Japan is a country that I love, the people I love, the people that I fought against and I hated. I didn't think they were human beings. They did their job honorably. They wasn't looked upon during the war as an honorable thing. But what we did to the American Indians and what the South did with the prison camps during the Civil War to the North, family members themselves, that's what war does to people. It creates...
And all sides are destroyed.
All sides are destroyed.
How did you... Because I think it's really such a wonderful concept that you bring out in terms of how you humanize the face of somebody who was so threatening at some point. How did that your son's father... Father-in-law. How did he humanize you and the people that he hated? How does that happen? Essentially, how do you turn war and trauma, as we were talking about, into not just peace, but as you started with that day of peace? How does that happen? How does that moment happen?
Yeah, it's a question that I've asked myself for a long time. We're raised with a firm belief in our nation. We're raised, most of us, with a firm belief in our religion. Those two things guide us. And yet, if we go beyond that into nature, we as human beings are all here for only one purpose, and that's to recreate ourselves. Every living thing has a role in life. Whether it's a bug or a piece of grass or it's a grapefruit tree or it's a lemon tree or it's a bird flying or a fish or a... We all are here for only one purpose, and that's to recreate ourselves. The tools come with us when we're born, and any sperm of any man can fertilize the egg of any woman on this earth, which means in nature, the whole world is exactly the same. What separates us is the belief that we're taught from a very young age. America's a democracy. You're not a democracy. We believe in this. Christians believe in one thing. The Muslims believe in one thing. Jewish people believe in another thing. And the fighting that goes on, especially today, is a fighting about belief. The Muhammad has been denigrated by a cartoonist in England. There's a big war going on by the Muslims. They want to recreate the world that they know without thinking about the world of other people. So the only way that that can happen, the only way world can come, people can come together, is to get to know them as human beings, not as Jewish human beings, not as Christian human beings, not as American, not as Japanese, not as Russian, just as people.
Let me interrupt again, but let's make sure we come back to what you're talking about, Jerry, because there's that.
By the way, it was France, not England.
Pardon me?
Never mind.
Okay.
Oh, in France, yeah, France. Yeah. Right. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
You are listening to KRUU Radio, 100.1 FM radio in Fairfield, Iowa. This is Mental Health Matters with Dr. Scott Terry. And our guest is Jerry Yellen. And I just wanted to go back to make sure that we cover, we're talking about the transition of your father-in-law and how he viewed you and you viewed him. But also there's the personal transition, the personal journey that you went through. That yeah. we haven't. You started, went back to the Merv Griffin show where you were. I think that's the beginning of your transition. But let's make sure we get back to that too.
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to do that, Rob. But I'd like to talk a little bit about my personal meeting with Mr. Yamakawa.
Okay.
After the ceremony.
The wedding ceremony.
The wedding ceremony,
yes.
Which was a traditional wedding ceremony.
And again, this is this process of humanizing.
Yes, this is what I want to talk about.
And I think that's so essential. I think you're right. In the world today, we've separated everybody. We're in these wars of belief. You're this, I'm that.
Right.
It's like, no, we're all in a body. We're all on the same planet. We all have the same goal to be human and to live and to grow and to ascend and evolve into something greater.
Exactly. Without transcendental meditation, I wouldn't be here today. I would have committed suicide. There's no question in my mind. There's 28 guys every day now who served in Iraq and Afghanistan commit suicide.
28?
28 every day, 6,000 a year. And TM works because it gives you something that you can hold on to yourself. It's not a drug. It's not psychiatry. It's something that you own, something that you do for yourself. And you get into the silence. You go beyond yourself. You transcend. You go beyond yourself. And you find peace within yourself by meditating. Or after the wedding, after Robert's wedding, we went to the Serioso Ryokan in Shimoda, Japan. And I stayed with Helene in the same my wife, 65 years last October.
Congratulations.
We stayed in the same room that Jimmy Carter and Rosalynn Carter stayed in the Serioso Ryokan in Shimoda when they were on a presidential visit. Hugely elegant place. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Yamakawa and I went into the onsen, the hot tub, the hot tub the size of a gymnasium, with a translator. And we sat for 3 hours revealing ourselves to each other. He asked me questions about the war and asked me about my personal life, asked me about Judaism, asked me about everything. And I told him what I knew, what I had done, told him how I felt. And he told me how he felt. He said, Yellen-san, I have two regrets in my life. One, I never fired a bullet at my enemy, the Americans, and I didn't die for my empire, for my emperor. Those were his beliefs. When we left, he in Japanese said to the translator that he never knew that there were other people in the world other than the Japanese who believed so strongly in education, in family, in health matters, in spiritual matters. And that was told to me in English. And it was an eye-opening, mind-opening experience to hear this from a man that had I seen him during the war, I would have killed him, or he would have killed me. It was an incredible experience to meet people that you hated and find out that they're family. They're just like you, speak a different language, eat with chopsticks, not with forks, sleep on the floor, not in beds, but they're all human beings exactly the same as me and you and everybody that's listening. Religion is a belief. Countries are, great to live in, proud to fight for them, proud to kill for them, but really we're destroying people just like ourselves, if we could take the time to get to know them, to really sit down and break bread in peace and in harmony. It's time we stop celebrating war. We celebrate now, this will be the 70th anniversary of VJ, Victory Over Japan Day. But it really should be celebrated in August of 2016 as an International Day of Peace, a day of reconciliation of people, not about the history of war, but the history of the rebuilding of Japan and Germany and Italy by the Americans who destroyed them, those countries, completely destroyed them. We rebuilt the country, but we still don't understand the culture of the people. The people are great. Even the German people, who, as a Jewish guy, I've never been to Germany. I don't think I'll ever go to Germany. There's a deep feeling about being a Jew in Germany and all the things that were done by the Holocaust. But if you get right down to it, the people of today didn't do that.
No. Right. And things have changed dramatically, obviously, in Germany as well. And there's a thriving renaissance there of Jewish culture, which is fought as well with now, you know, so
well,
much
anti-Semitism is coming back against the world.
Huge.
It's a Christian thing.
Absolutely. Huge.
Yeah.
And so, again, this message of humanization and getting past our own belief systems and our own cultural insecurities so that we could find some freedom is, I think, absolutely what's essential.
Yeah, I think it's... I would like to see it. Jacques Cousteau, I heard him talk maybe 55, 60 years ago.
Yeah.
And he said, the Earth is like a planet, like an airplane. The planet is like an airplane. It's held together by rivets. And we, in an airplane, can lose 1,000 rivets or 10,000 rivets or 600,000 rivets. But there's one rivet. If you lose that, the whole world is going to, the whole airplane is going to go down. And life on Earth, from the insects to the animals to the plants to the humans, are all the rivets of the Earth. And we're losing them. There's a place in Panama that 50 years ago you couldn't walk in the forest without stepping on a golden frog. They have one golden frog left now in the whole world. And they don't know if it's a male or female. So that's gone. Fish are being lost because of the warming of the seas. The way we farm is killing the insects and the bugs. They're all the rivets that hold us together. And we, as human beings, are doing a lot to destroy the Earth, too. And we're doing it because of greed. We're doing it because of our culture. We're doing it because we want nice things, better things. And we have to start looking about the people in this world as being the same as us. And if we destroy the planet, we don't know what's going to happen. We won't know what's going to happen. And it's the human being that's doing it.
And so the way to conclude our wonderful talk, and Jerry, I think we'd love to just keep going, and we might just do a second show. But let's try and think. We're going to do some show at some point, I guarantee you. But what I'd like to conclude with is that wonderful thought you made and how we get past this destruction. And it's coming past the belief systems to that sense of humanity and creating something greater and using tools like the meditation or whatever the tool is to create that transformation in all of us. What do you want to close out?
Well, a lot of us, I read a book when I was young, 13 years old, my bar mitzvah year, called The Magnificent Obsession. Huh. And that book stayed with me.
Yeah.
It's about a Christian, it was written by a Christian man, Lloyd Douglas, who was a minister. And it's about a doctor and a scion of a very wealthy young man who is drowning, and the doctor's having a heart attack, and there's one resuscitator in the fire department, and they choose to save the young man, and the doctor dies. And they discover his journal when thousands of people come to his funeral. And his philosophy in life was, give yourself away to someone every single day, and don't tell anybody that you did some good for somebody else. And that brought life together for him. So if we can give ourselves away, each one of us, every day, to someone else, and not talk about it, the world will benefit, because someone else will know who we are and what we are because we told them.
And at that, thank you so much, Jerry. Mental Health Matters.